At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
It's Lord of the Rings without the substance. This book could be a great book if you just change all the characters.
How am I supposed to empathize with, like, is this our rootable character? Am I supposed to root for this person?
Lila Insufferable, not fun, don't want to talk about it. Rich, what else should we do? What do you want for dinner? I don't know. I'm just trying to think of...
Welcome everyone to the Tudor Round Podcast. My name is Richard.
My name's Austin.
Today we're talking about V.E. Schwab's book, A Darker Shade of Magic, book one of, I believe, her first trilogy. Now, the first 10-ish, 15 minutes, we're going to be talking spoiler-free about the book, what the book's about, what do other people think about it, what are our spoiler-free thoughts about it, and then after that, we're going to get full spoilers. We will warn you when that happens. Ready to talk about this book?
I am. All right. You said it's the first of a trilogy. We've only read this book so far. It's our introduction into the world of V.E. Schwab and our first time reading a work from her. It was our book club selection for the month of June. So shout out to our patrons who selected it. We had our book club discussion. So we'll try to include some of their thoughts as well. Here's our soft opinion real quick, because Rich and I have discussed this in the book club. Our soft spoiler-free opinion is we didn't like it.
Yep.
But we will attempt to say who is this book for, and then we'll express why we did not like the book. Now, to pitch this book and get you the genre, the type of story that you expect to read. So, Rich, what should people expect? What is the synopsis of the book? Again, spoiler-free synopsis.
Got it. Back of the book, chapter one kind of info.
Yep.
Book follows a man or a young man named Kel, and he is a magician. And a big part of this is he's a magician in London. Big world-building aspect is there's actually three Londons, parallel
four,
Londons.
Four Londons.
I'm getting to that one.
Oh.
That's part of the setup. That's
sorry.
You ruined this.
I'm sorry.
You ruined the setup and the surprise. There's actually four Londons. Whatever. There's Red London, magical London. It's the land of opportunities and greatness. Then there's Grey London, basically our London without any magic. It's sad. It's depressing. It's gray. Then there's White London. White London is scary. They control magic. They want to own it. And they're dwindling magic. Scary place. Scary, scary. And then there's the secret, not very much talked about, not really seen, Black London.
Is that the fourth one I was talking about?
That's the fourth one.
Oh, hey.
So all of these parallel worlds have different governments, different systems, all the different landscapes. The one commonality is London exists, and it is a central point. So Kel is a magician who hops between Londons, delivering mail between kings and leaders, and also a little smuggling on the side.
Because he is an Antari, and there's only two of them that we really see in this book, and the people that can hop from London to London, you have to be Kel, this Antari who can actually traverse through the Londons using a bit of the magic system, which you'll explore when you read the book.
Yep.
So that's the premise. Great, great job premising. Sorry, I ruined the surprise with the fourth London there. I'm hoping they do mention there's four Londons on the back there. That wasn't a spoiler, was it?
It was a spoiler for the first like two sentences I wanted to say.
Okay.
That's how long the spoiler was going to last.
Got it. Okay. So this book, to get you into the feel as well, this is a 19, 20-year-old protagonist. I believe this is geared toward new adult. A new adult is that age range that is after YA. So YA is 12 to 18 years old. New adult is 19, 20, 21, 22, and so on. That's probably the target audience. I would say just a brief opinion, criticism on my part, is it reads more so for YA, even though the target audience might seem older. There's usually the rule of thumb, if your protagonist is 19 and 20, you're trying to reach people around that age range or a couple years younger. Now, again, some people will call this YA. I would lean more into the complexity and the plot itself speaks more YA, yet I do think it's attempting to reach those 20-something-year-olds, and that's a part of the criticism as well. I don't know if the book lands the target audience perfectly. However, okay, put that aside. If you've read some other similar books, what are some similar books, Rich, you would recommend that if they like this, they might like A Darker Shade of Magic?
Honestly, I think Hunger Games falls into this as well. I mean, just age range of, I can imagine someone like just off the back of Hunger Games maybe would also like this book. Books that are similar in story.
I have a thought on that.
I haven't read too many urban fantasy, in all honesty. So it's, I don't have a bunch of things right off the top of my head.
It's different plot, different book. However, A Thousand Deaths of Arthur Benn.
Yes.
That one comes to mind as in similar age range. It has similar prose. It just a story type and beat that I think that this reader would appreciate in that sort. So if you've read that, you might also like this book. Now, it's not A Thousand Deaths of Arthur Benn isn't a super popular book. I think Hunger Games is a more popular one to say, if you like that, you might like this. But yeah, okay. So our patrons, shout out to the book club. If you guys want to join our book club, we do a book every single month and sometimes more. You just had a Monte Cristo read that you did with them. And that, join our Patreon in the top of the description. But our patrons in the book club generally agreed as well. I don't think We had one or two. Shout out Rania for selecting the book.
Also Gecko. And Gecko liked the book
Gecko
as well.
Liked the book. And the vast, vast majority either thought it was very middling or did not like it. So at least in our book club, this was the mass majority opinion. Online, you'll see plenty of people do like the book. I think to also kind of zone in on that target audience for those Ranyas out there, for the people that do like Darker Shade of Magic, is if you can self-identify with the character Lila in here, and there is a young female protagonist, an adventurer, and I would say on the negative side, it's the I'm not like other girls trope. However, if you do like that trope and it doesn't bother you, and you want to have a character that you can self-identify with and just adventurous spirit, a fun, fast-paced, it's a fast-paced story, action, adventure, that could be up your alley. Now, Rich, slam it into him, though, with your spoiler-free ramble rating of why it isn't for you. And your spoiler-free thoughts, of course.
Sure. My overall thoughts for this book is I gave it a 2.5, ultimately disappointing book. Mm. The rest of the scores for every category, cheer. Thank you, Nick. Ultimately, it just fell short in mainly the plot and characters for me were the real standouts of just really lacking. Also, the prose for me kind of got annoying. There was especially some of the dialogue. I think the description was fine. Nothing particularly wrong with it. Mm-hmm. It's very clear prose in a Sanderson vein of very clear descriptions, not really flowery language, but I found some of the dialogue a little cringe.
I have a thing I noticed that might make you even cringe more.
What did you notice?
I'll show examples during the spoiler review, I promise. I gave the book a 2 stars, flawed. So 2 out of 5, and I think the main gripe I have with this book, the worst category would be characters. Here's all my categories you can see below for what I rated. Mm-hmm. Lila, the character in here, to me, was insufferable. I did not like her, so I'll be ranting in the character section a lot. I think the book, it's not that the book just followed the tropes and followed a storyline. Sure, there wasn't any surprises of that sort. Mm-hmm. It was just how it handled, the characters and the dialogue and everything came across as very uninspired. In that way, I think it was a very that V. Schwab, when she wrote this, had a great idea and was inspired with an idea, but then the actual execution of that idea just left you thinking you could have done so much more with this concept. The Four Londons, great concept, cool world. Also, as far as the plot goes, even though I'll have my gripes, it was fast paced and paced really well.
Yeah,
So I shouldn't, that's a little bit redundant to say fast paced and paced really well. It doesn't have to be paced well to be fast paced.
It can be fast paced and paced poorly.
Exactly.
Of which most of the book is paced well, except for the ending, which is paced way too fast. It's too fast of a pace and needed to slow down a little bit.
Yep.
But
and hey,
we'll get into those details.
We're the negative Nancys. Even Patrick Leo gave this a 3-star. That's pretty low for him, for Patrick.
That is pretty
low. That's low. He gave book 2 a 1-star. So if anybody is thinking about going on, that's just a little forewarning from...
Patrick Leo gave it a 1-star?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah, you got to call the president after that.
Oh,
it's like,
God. that's a wrap. Oh, Lord.
Yeah, you got to... Something's going wrong.
Something's going real wrong.
Yeah.
My Lord.
I'm almost... I'm curious.
Oh,
in a bad way.
Is it bad that I want to read book 2 more now? Because Patrick Leo rated it a 1.
How much worse does it get?
Yeah, exactly. What could happen?
I don't know.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. that's spoiler free for this. Do you have anything else to say before we give the warning?
Yeah. This is a book that I have seen on bookshelves for years.
Yeah.
V. Schwab is constantly on the table for recommended books. It's always front and center at Barnes & Noble. Everywhere, they always have multiple copies.
Yep.
And I just never got around to reading this book. And I finally have. A little disappointed. So it's... Oh, well. I do think it's mainly just a book not for me. Even though the main character is Kel, is this 19, 20-year-old man. I think it is more targeted toward a woman audience, generally, as well.
We should use this example.
I would say, I think that is, it's not exclusive. It's not like, oh, this is only for women. Clearly isn't. But I have a feeling that is generally the audience that will like it more.
We should have said this in that part, too. It was still spoiler free. But Mistborn, how Vin's a 16-year-old character in Mistborn, I think the target audience is similar to, if you read Mistborn, you read V. Schwab's The Darker Shade of Magic, where those audiences, or I should say this.
It's
then
same. It's targeted toward the same age, but I also think flipped gender of, even though Vin is a young girl, I think it's targeted toward slightly young men. Probably will like it more, just generally of like
is that type of story.
Kelsier is a big part of it. Yeah. Every guy loves Kelsier.
But no, I think there's...
And where this book has, it's, yeah, Kel is the a male main character. And yet, I think a lot of women will read this really identifying with Lila or really like that type of protagonist, and that will be a big draw.
Yeah, only thing on that is Mistborn has everybody, men and women. That's got a huge audience
sides. It's definitely not like, when I say target and like a target demographic, that's not like a 90-10 split. It's probably like 45. 55. Yeah, 55. It's like 55-60, maybe.
I wouldn't be surprised if more women have read Mistborn, to be honest. I wouldn't be too surprised.
Quantity? Yeah. Or in general, women read more than men anyway, so probably right.
But regardless, that's similar age range. That's your kind of feel as well you're getting of new adult. We're rambling way too much and spoiler free for this part of it, but that is what to expect going into A Darker Shade of Magic. Anything else?
Let's get right into it. So, okay. Spoiler warning.
Spoilers.
You've had your warning.
Yes.
What did you give your emotional impact score?
2 stars.
2 stars.
Yep.
Flawed. Just out of the gate.
Yep.
I gave it a 2.5.
So it matches our overall.
Yep, it does. Yep. So disappointing this time.
Yep.
A lot of this book is I'm thinking, hey, if I was a different audience, maybe this would land for me. So it's ultimately to me, I see why people would like it.
Right.
It just really doesn't work for me, and there's some things that really don't. So that's why I was saying disappointing rather than flawed.
Gotcha. What do you think it's going for?
I mean, it's going for the adventure, action-packed, excitement.
Mm-hmm.
In a big way, it's trying to be, it's trying to get your immersion. It's going for the full world immersion and escape. That's ultimately what
book's going for.
I know. Well, no, it's classic in that sense of it is just an escape book. I don't think it's particularly trying to pull on your heartstrings a lot. I don't think it has any particular emotional beats that it's really beating hard other than your sense of adventure.
I think it is going for those deeper emotions when we get to the Rye almost dying portion. And sure. We get to, the threat of your best friend. So I think there's those beats, especially in the fast-paced portion in the end, that we can get to. But yeah, I think you're right. The adventurous feel. You're looking for...
Yeah. I think that's primary. Fun, yeah, everything that, else that is secondary.
Yeah, I actually have an example of just talking about trying to get your heart beating and how much did this get you in the feel and the emotions behind it? Because you said that the book is not particularly going for these heartbreaking moments in that sense. And I think, here, I'm going to pull up the exact page. I just want to use this as an example of why it was more emotionally muted to me. Now, right before I read this passage, I will say the best part about the book is it was such a quick, easy read, and the concept was cool enough to you could breeze through this book. So I didn't hate this. I'm just, if the book was less readable, I would have hated this scene more. But okay, this is toward the end where Lila's in battle, and you're going, at this point, I imagine your heart's supposed to be pumping of what's going to happen, what's going to happen next. And this is Lila essentially saying that she might die. So here's what it says on page 366. Lila's back hit the pillar hard. She crumpled to the stone floor of the throne room, and blood ran into her false eye as she struggled to push herself to her hands and knees. Her shoulder cried out with pain, but so did the rest of her. She tried not to think about it. Astrid, meanwhile, seemed to be having a grand time. She was smiling lazily at Lila like a cat with a kitchen mouse. "I'm going to cut that smile off your face," growled Lila as she staggered to her feet. She had been in a lot of fights with a lot of people, but she'd never fought anyone like Astrid Dane. The woman moved with both jarring speed and awkward grace, one moment slow and smooth, the next striking so fast that it was all Lila could do to stay on her feet, stay alive. Lila knew she was going to lose. Lila knew she was going to die, but she'd be damned if it counted for nothing. Judging by the rumbling of the castle grounds around them, Kel had his hands full. The least she could do was keep the number of Danes he had to fight to one, buy him a little time. Honestly, what had happened to her? The Lila Bard of South London looked out for herself. That Lila could never waste her life on someone else. She'd never choose right over wrong, so long as wrong meant staying alive. She'd never have turned back to help the stranger who helped her. Lila spit a mouthful of blood and straightened. Perhaps she should have never stolen the damn stone, but even here and now, facing death in the form of a pale queen, she didn't regret it. She'd wanted freedom, she'd wanted adventure, and she didn't think she minded dying for it. She only wished dying didn't hurt so much. Da 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 da. Okay, keeps going there. Now, so I wanted to read that section because, like, that's in the heat of the battle and the action and how the story occurred up to this point. I think even before that, Rye came back to life and almost died. But as much as Lila's thinking in her head, this threat of violence, this threat of death, not for one second did I think Lila's not going to make it out of this fight against the twins. And I think a lot of the emotions is the character thinking, or even her. She's saying in her head her character arc. She's saying in her head, okay, I used to be like this. Now I'm like this.
Yeah.
Plenty of books do this as well. I get it, especially the target demographic. I get it. But that kind of the action and the high intensity kind of missed for me of, oh, I'm supposed to be feeling Lila could not make it out of this. And this is the moment I'm supposed to care the most about. However, everything leading up to that moment, which we'll fill in the gaps for, did not lead me to believe that Lila was in danger against the twins. I didn't feel any stakes when it came to the climax. Did you feel particularly different? I imagine not.
Yeah, no. But I don't even think it's about the predictability nature of it.
No,
it's just your connection to the character.
Yeah.
You can know because... just how the characters are, and you're like, oh, this character isn't dying. It's one of the main characters. Mm-hmm. It's the nature of the book. It's clearly going to have another book with them, but you can still feel for them in those moments if you're attached emotionally to the character. And so you would be immersed a little bit further.
Yeah.
I wasn't. I don't think I disliked Lila as much as you.
Oh, yeah.
She was mildly annoying to me, and I wasn't connected, but I didn't despise her character. But yeah, I didn't care particularly when she was in that situation.
Yeah. Well, was there a moment, because for you, is there a moment in the book that stands out as something you hated or loved, or is it all just kind of muted?
It's mostly muted. The one moment where I was confused.
Yeah.
We talked about this in the book club. To give a little setup, Lila is, before that scene that Austin read out Lila is going into the throne room to kill Astrid Dane to, you know, help Kells defeat White London and set all the world right. Anyway, she's walking in and all of these soldiers are compelled to defend the castle. But ultimately, by their rules, like, not actually defend against her, only defend against Kell, whatever. And then there's a tiny, like, little boy defending the, like, standing in front of the door to the throne room. And he holding a sword, and he's like, and, you know, Lila's like, get out of the way, kid. Don't want to hurt you, but I gotta go kill that queen. And he's like, I can't. I have to defend this door. And she's like, no, you don't. Get out of the way. And he's like, I'm literally magically compelled. I am a slave. I have a slave mark. I can't actually do anything. I have to defend this door or else I die. Mm. And Lila, instead of thinking, like, my immediate thought is, like, the word phrasing of there is, I have to defend this door. I'm going, oh, is she going to ask is this a little moment of empathy that we're going to see out of her and go, like, okay, you have to defend this door. Is there another way into the throne room? And that way she can get through without him having to break his compulsion and all this stuff. And she just goes, how would you like to die? And then, like, slits the boy's throat and just, like, or whatever. She stabs him in the heart, whatever it is, and kills him and then walks through. And not even a moment's hesitation or the book trying to say that, you know, man, Lila's, like, this was a hard decision, or it was a eerily easy decision for her. That was just glossed over, of just kills this innocent little boy and is perfectly fine with it. We're moving on. I'm like, what? How am I supposed to empathize with, like, is this our rootable character? Am I supposed to root for this person? I'm not. She's a psychopath. Like, that's a psychopath thought of, like, I am seeing innocent little boy compelled by magic, tortured, really, to defend this door. And I'm not going to think of, like, option two. Not even a hint of, like, oh, maybe I can try to save him.
Yeah, you're right. And
that was confusing as hell to me. What the hell was that?
The big issue is too, because I probably jumped the gun even reading that scene. We're backtracking. I want that scene, then you want that. We have to even go back further to who Lila's character is, because the scene I read of, oh, I don't believe she's going to die, and the scene you're looking at of, wait, shouldn't there be more weight involved to killing a child?
Shouldn't there be some kind of way or the other of, yep. Oh, the book writing of, like, it was really easy for her to do it. And, mm-hmm. like, a little bit of, like, she's a little messed up. Mm-hmm. Something that, like, oh, yes. There's some weight there. Or her struggling with it. One way or the other. The book just doesn't give a shit, apparently.
The issue is the book more so idolizes Lila in the sense of everything that we are told through the...
I'm sorry, people complain when we...
It is Lila. Delilah Bard, Lila. Lila's her name. Yes. And... the issue with these scenes, the build-up to, hey, that action scene, or the build-up to the weight of killing that kid, everything surrounding Lila, every person surrounding Lila, we are told that she is not like other girls, and she is one of a kind, and she is great. We see that because Kel, as he's talking about her, says, I've never seen someone stronger. Oh, my God. Oh, yeah. Lila's
never
amazing.
Seen someone I've never seen someone... She's so smart, and she's
exactly.
witty, intelligent. I'm going, like, you know, for such a witty and smart character, she can't figure out a way to not kill the child. That was in my I still keep coming back to that. I'm like,
yeah, it's gonna scar you.
It was literally the poor
kid who's dead on the ground.
It was the first thought in my head of, like, oh, what's another way into the throne room? At least ask the question. Nope. I'm just gonna kill the kid.
It's just about the adventure, man. Who cares who dies on the journey? And yeah, another scene where she meets Rye, and Rye, for the first time, they have a little dialogue exchange back and forth. And Rye, I have the quote down here. He says, I like this one. Can I borrow her? Oh, and so the scene I'm talking about here is where Rye and Lila meet again for the first time. And Rye is just stunned by her wit and how charming she is. And wow, Lila's special. Everything that is being told around Lila is how wonderful she is, how one of a kind she is, how adventurous she is. And her introduction to Lila's character as well. So there's sexual assault involved in her, one of her first two scenes that's involved. Then soon...
Yeah. So she's introduced with... She's introduced fairly early on. I don't know if it's like the first introduction, like first chapter with her.
Yeah.
Or like the second. Introduced with like she is sexually assaulted or at least attempted sexual assault against her. And she defends herself, kills the guy, and in a way to drive sympathy for her character. And then like the second she meets our other main character, Kel, she sexually assaults him. And the, I was just so like,
the introduction with
Kel. I'm still supposed to sympathize with him.
The scene you're talking about is at this point, Lila has the stone. The stone, which is the whole plot of this book, is we have to throw this stone, which is from Black London. We have to get it back to Black London because if the stone being out of Black London, it can do insane powers. It can do basically anything. It has a. What's up?
We are jumping around a little bit. Do you want to move away from emotional impact? Is there anything of like...
Oh, yeah.
We're just moving on.
No, yeah, this next point, and then we can move on.
Got it.
Yeah, so this stone is being used to... You can do all sorts of powers with it. And the introductory scene with Lila is she... Oh, sorry, her meeting Kel, she uses the stone... And because sorry, let me backtrack 1 second. So Kel,
we're gonna work our way backwards.
Work away all the way back to the beginning of the book. Kel and Lila meet. Kel leaves Lila accidentally. Well, not accidentally. The stone was stolen by Lila. Or did she steal it? Or did he leave it? At least she stole it. She steals everything.
She steals from literally everyone.
Everybody.
She meets, and she 100%
She looks at the stone and goes, "Oh, this is nothing. What is this?" And then Kel comes back to get the stone because that's the evil stone they need to destroy in Mount Mordor, in the Mount Doom. Did I say Mount Mordor? God damn it. So he wants to retrieve the stone, and she goes, "No, this must be special if you're trying to retrieve it." And then she uses the stone's powers to create a clone of Kel and starts stripping the clone of Kel and teasing him, going, "Ooh, look, Kel, look how quirky this is." It's a little getting a little titillating. And from the way it reads, it's supposed to read cutesy, and it reads as in that's supposed to be a little flirtatious in that way. I mean, put the roles reversed. If Kel was using a stone to undress a version of Lila, and you go, "Oh, that's creepy," right?
Yeah.
But then in
very,
but since it's coming from Lila's character, and it's written in this kind of quirky, again, not like other girls. Look how edgy she is. And so it just emphasizes how we as the reader are supposed to root for her. That is the messaging come across, yet she comes across as extremely insufferable in those ways of she's not as quirky as she thinks she is. She's not like, sure, she is not like other girls, hence is like other girls, because her not trying not to be like other girls, she becomes that cliche. Anyways, the last thing in emotional impact, because we were veering in the characters, I just wanted to say it's important to mention Lila's characters early because a lot of the cringe that I got was from her point of view. For example, on page 386, this is the one scene where you can kind of get beat for beat where I was not the target audience. So this is a scene where Kel and Lila, they defeated everybody and Lila's going to walk away. So then I'll find my way, said Lila. Kel nodded and led her to the courtyard wall. He made a mark on the pale stones and dug the red London coin from his pocket. And then he pulled Lila close, wrapped his broken body around hers, and tipped his forehead against hers. "Hey, Lila," he said softly, the space between them. "Yeah?" He pressed his mouth to hers for one brief moment, the warmth there and then gone. She frowned up at him, but did not pull away. "What was that for?" she asked. "For luck. Not that you need it." And then he pressed his hand against the wall and thought of home. I'm sorry. So reading that, maybe somebody can read that and enjoy, but I'm reading that going, this is just the most hallmark, bare bones, word for word, stale dialogue and stale scene ever of affection where, hey, for luck, not that you need it. Then he put his hand on the wall and he thought of home. I can't think of something just more, all right, that it came across as extremely childish. Yet at the same time, these are 19, 20-year-olds. if these were teenagers, age this down 5 years, that comes across as, ah, look at that teenage romance type of thing. This, mm-hmm. this is, again, supposed to be more new adult. So as I'm reading this, I'm going, okay, this does not read for that, me at least. So anyways, that's just part of the emotional impact. But did you want to say anything else in that part?
No, most of the dialogue for me was, especially the more romantic stuff, came across very cringy. Or any kind of heightened emotional dialogue of anger, romance, whatever, just didn't land very well for me.
Yeah, fair enough.
All right, moving on to thought-provoking.
What'd you give it?
N.A.
N.A. Not applicable.
Yeah, no, that's generous, too. That's a generous N.A. Because I could give an actual score, and I'll be honest, I don't think it's going for one. Like, maybe, like, surface level of... you know, balance, you know, white London tries to control magic and red London, the good London, is trying to be in harmony with men, I guess, but no.
I gave it a 1.5 stars. I gave it bad. I almost gave it NA. I almost gave it NA, but two things made me actually rate the category. One is it was going for some thematic elements, I think. The big one is trying to throw the stone into Mount Doom. It's the temptation of magic, temptation of stone. Yeah. It's all
power
it's,
corrupts.
Yeah, it's Lord of the Rings without the substance. That's the first thing. However, that's fine. But I'm putting more of the themes, which we can skip right the characters. I'm putting more of the themes into the how the characters' arcs mean their thematic elements. How the moral of the story from the characters. I'm putting more into that. And so my thought provokingness is kind of leaning more into we can start getting into Lila for the characters.
Oh, because yeah. For both her and Kel,
yeah.
They were kind of set up with an idea of characters with flaws they maybe need to overcome or confront or whatever they need.
Yeah.
And ultimately never really addressed at all. And then Lila is perfect at the end, like stays exactly who she is because she's the best. And then Kel does nothing, like basically the rest of the book.
You want to talk characters? Because my thought provoking part just leans into
Let's
that.
Go right into so it. Let's I, go right into gave, Lila as well. We were already yeah, talking
I
about
I have 1.5 stars for characters. Bad. I did not like the characters.
Yeah. On initial reaction, I gave a 2.5 because I didn't particularly hate Lila, but I really should just give it a 2.
2, fair enough.
Yeah. Okay. The more we were just talking about it, like that's more accurate to say.
We talked about Lila a bunch already. Now, her arc, as what the arc is supposed to be and going for, was in the action sequence that I just read earlier. Her arc is she is adventurous and kind of a loner and a bit selfish. She steals stuff for her own, and she's very self-preserving. But then when it comes to the adventure itself and with Kel, she takes on the other twin and does something and kind of puts herself out there in a sacrificial type of way for the team and for Kel. She doesn't just think about herself. That's the meta arc of what Lila is going for here. Selfish adventurer. I'm going to go do this. I'm going to become a pirate. Learns on the way. Ah, okay. I need to help Kel as well. I've gained empathy for Kel in this situation. That's her arc. Fair enough.
Supposedly. Yeah.
Fair enough. Yeah. So us talking about the, I'm not like other girls with those scenes of Kel saying how strong she is and Rye going, ooh, how much I like her. Every beat there. So the way that I saw her character from the start, she wants to go on this grand adventure and she steals things nonstop. She's a stealer. And I guess the premise of her character when she was introduced, you could kind of see that you've read how many different characters like Lila in the past. Did you immediately see similarities of, okay, I know the exact trope of character this is, and you said at first you didn't hate her as much. I guess where's that coming from? Of did you read her and think differently in the moment and in post? Is it any different?
I guess it really is. I've seen this character before, and I just tuned it out as much. I wasn't as annoyed with her just... I really don't know. I think I just tuned her out, really.
Sorry, we're struggling with this review. We talked about this book for 3 hours, and we don't want to talk about it for another 2. So this whole book is, if I could just put a 5-sentence review out there, I don't know why I said five. Let me now talk in five sentences. Lila Insufferable, not fun, don't want to talk about it. Rich, what else should we do? What do you want for dinner? I don't know. I'm just trying to think of, because it's hard to say that this is, wow, this isn't the worst book, wasn't done poorly. It's actually one of those that, talking about her character, there's not much to say other than, okay, that was her arc, the insufferable portions that we already talked about. However, her want from the beginning is she wants to go on this adventure. And what does she do at the end? She does. She eventually she has her adventure with Kel, then goes off to become a pirate like she always wanted to. And throughout that journey of killing the innocent kid and going through the several Londons, she doesn't, on that journey, doesn't seem to push against that initial want. She gets what she wanted all along. She wants that's her core want, is the adventure. The stealing and the selfishness is never a flaw presented in the book. The stealing is always, oh, she steals stuff. One, it's presented as quirky and fun that she steals stuff. Two, her stealing stuff and all that gains her admiration, or it makes her look as more of a competent and well-liked character. There's never pushback when she steals stuff. All the moments, and she stole the orb in the first place, and that got her the adventure, actually. So her being this quote-unquote selfish, stealing, supposedly flawed character, the flaws are all presented as quirks that we're supposed to go, oh, Lila's she's not like those other girls. Look at her wanting this adventure. Look at her stealing like this. But every time she does that, it only leads her further to the thing she actually wants, which is an adventure. So she not only gets what she wants, she also then, the lesson that she learns of, oh, okay, I'll actually help out Kel, because she starts being more empathetic and not totally selfish person. Well, that whole portion as well, at what point, I could see that arc, but I'm just trying to emphasize the point that flaws...
That whole idea her learning empathy as her arc comes like face-to-face with her just killing this innocent child with no sympathy, no regard, not even an attempt to try and save this child's life, that not threatening her in any way.
Yeah.
It's that kind of thing of like, did she really learn empathy? Of that wasn't even a hard decision for her. Like, that could have been a moment for her realizing, hell, make it, you know, slap her in the face of like the actual author telling us, remembering, oh, if this, you know, just a couple days ago, I would have easily killed this person just because they're in my way, and now I'm trying. I could have had a little moment of her going significantly out of her way to like go the harder path so she can get into the throne room, mm-hmm. so she could save the child, because that's the empathy, and the empathy costs something. And her realizing, going, man, look at what I'm doing to to defend this innocent child.
Mm-hmm.
Empathy. But no, she just cuts his throat. It's like, I've learned empathy on this journey.
That,
I didn't.
You have it spot on, because it's not that she learns empathy. She learns she has romantic feelings for Kel.
Yeah.
The lesson really from her is, oh, Kel and her are starting to get a flirtatious vibe and they like each other. They kissed. And because of that, I'm going to try to help the person I'm kind of in love with, or I really like her, whatever the relationship point is at. That's all it was. It was, she got adventure plus romance plus she steals plus she's quirky. So everything in the end was pretty good for Lila. And well, it's always...
There's also a real problem with, generally in storytelling.
Yeah.
The character's wants and needs generally shouldn't be the same. There's, of course, exceptions to rules, but for an interesting story of a character has very clear wants other than survival...
She wants adventure.
Wants adventure. To make it a very interesting character story,
mm-hmm.
the need should be something other than the want.
Well, the flaw should inhibit that as well.
Yeah.
That the flaw should directly inhibit the thing that you need to obtain. So, for example, if her thing is, hey, I want an adventure, and what kind of flaw would make that need more impactful? What does she need to learn from that want? Because, well, first off, her want is adventure, and by the end, she does attain adventure. That want seems to always be a need. The want and need were both the same, it seems like, because she needed an adventure, but she also wanted an adventure.
And ultimately, that's really not interesting.
And how does her flaw of stealing impact her want slash need whatsoever.
Yeah, it doesn't.
It propels it. Her flaw of look how special she is, look how amazing with all of her quirks.
Her particular flaw in this book, I think it's hinted at, but not really dived into, is her relationship with Baron, her pseudo-esque father figure.
Mm-hmm.
And there shows to be this connection where she is a loner. She pushes away human connection. She just wants to be by herself and she'll make it on her own, this fierce independence, and wants that individual adventure. And over the course of this, she realizes, oh, I can have human connection and also adventure. And so she needs to, you know, mm-hmm. not be an isolated prick. But she realized she can kind of just do it all.
But to your point too, the need in a story, the need of a character should often be you want the wrong thing. So the character wants something, but they don't realize, oh, they needed this all along. So this would be a different story. But let's say Lila, she really wants to not Bilbo Baggins, chapter one. She wants to stay in her Shire. She wants to just stay in this London. She needs to realize she needs to go on the adventure, and there's all this grand world. Da, da, da. Different story. However, her from the get-go want and need collide, are similar, and her character flaw seems to not inhibit those goals whatsoever. And at the same time, we're being told, look how amazing she is. Look how quirky she is.
That is a trope, or that's a cliche that I really don't like, of you take the new character that just inherently is not as likable.
Yeah.
And the writers tend to actually know that. And so they use a different character that is more likable to literally just say to the audience face of, I like this one.
Which is Rye. Because Rye is likable because he was presented. Rye's mini character here is, we know he and Kel have a good friendship. And that's probably the highlight. I like that they were friends. That was cool. Yeah. And the story that's told from Kel's point of view is Kel says when Rye was 13 or something, he was kidnapped by these people. And when Kel came and saved him, or when the kidnappers gave Rye up, Rye then was merciful to the kidnappers and did not, and thought that they would give mercy back. It shows that he's actually a kind prince. He's not this stuck up rich kid that you'd expect him to be, having the king and queen as mother and father. And Kel, on the other hand, did kill them and did have revenge. He did not have that mercy that Rye did. So Rye showed to have this soft heart and is presented as a likable character. Then to your point, he says,
I like this one. Like, I think almost word for word, which reminds me of a similar moment with, God, I sound like such a tool.
What?
But Marvel did the same thing. It's the thing that stuck in my head, at least, mm-hmm. of an example of in Avengers Endgame, of when Thor meets Captain Marvel for the first time.
Oh, yeah.
And like literally 5 seconds in, and Thor, the more likable established character, says, I like this one. It's like, God, like that's the trick up your sleeve. We're supposed to like the character because the character we actually like says.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
We should like them. Rather than just writing a funny scene with them to actually get you to like them.
Was that after Captain Marvel did some cool superpower thing, or was that after a dialogue scene? Was that the walk-in dialogue scene?
Yes.
That's the same as this. That's a great example.
It's the same thing.
Exact thing.
Yeah, no.
So annoying.
I don't remember what Captain Marvel said
something,
like,
witty.
Something
that was supposed to be witty.
Supposed to be witty, or mainly she's just strong-willed of like, well, I would have just killed him. And something like that. And Thor's like, I like this one. God. I don't like that cliche. Just write a fun scene with them. Don't literally make your character say to the audience, I like this character, so should you.
That's the exact problem with it.
The thing is, Rye also has the exact same problem.
Mm-hmm.
And to a certain, there's maybe to a lesser degree.
Right.
But we do get some scenes with, we get that example of him pardoning the kidnappers. But we frequently get Kel just saying, oh yeah, he's well loved. Oh yeah, he's so likable and charming, and literally just told these things about him mm-hmm. into making him likable.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and what do you think about Kel and his character? Because I think we beat Lila to death at this point of
yeah.
why I just think she's a bad character. But what do you think about Kel?
I mean, he's kind of a nothing burger. That's what he is. They start out with his whole flaw is he's a, I guess, a kleptomaniac. Not the exact same. Like
kleptomaniac.
He steals, but he smuggles. I guess he doesn't technically steal anything, but he smuggles away trinkets from the other Londons
mm-hmm.
for it, even though it's illegal and he could get whatever punished from the king and queen for doing it. But he does it anyway. Who knows why? It just seems to be his quirk. And it's what gets him in trouble for this whole story of he decides to take this black magic stone across London's. That's apparently his flaw. Can you think of another one other than him just being naive and just he hasn't actually had to struggle in his whole life?
I think his main conflict that's presented seems to be he is not true family with the king and queen and Rye, but he sees Rye as brothers, but he's not accepted as a son from the king and queen. So he doesn't exactly fit in. But he's treated well, so it's that line of he doesn't feel like he belongs there. I think that is the presentation.
How the hell does this story go into that at all?
It's said. It's told.
It's said. But the story doesn't go into that relationship at all. It doesn't explore it. It's just said. How does the relationship with Lila maybe change this dynamic? Does he discover a newfound family? And he just goes, hey, look, I value my found family over the one that was given to me. And no, the story doesn't go into any of this. It's just told to us. Yeah, Kel has this problem. Is it going to be addressed in this book? Nope. Is it going to get worse for Kel because of this book? No.
Just like Lila probably being a Tari is not going to be addressed until later books, because her having a glass eye is hint, hint, nudge, nudge. She was also an Atari. Antari at one point.
Antari.
Antari at one point.
Yeah. And so, well, she still is. Just clearly, at some point, the person who cared about her, whatever. Don't know if I would say the father, because the father apparently sold her as a, sex object, slave thing, whatever. So probably the mother saw that Lila's eye went black. It's like, oh, she's an Antari. She'll be stripped of magic, blah, blah, blah. And then, popped the eye out. Anyway, that's just the theory. Sorry. That just comes out of you. When you just... You hear that's a theory.
That's got to be fact at this point.
Yeah.
I mean, it's so hinted. That's got to be the case. So Lila, look, I'm not going to go back to Lila. Kel, can I go back to Lila for one moment?
Sure.
Because you made a good point in the book club where we were talking about why is it, I'm so sorry. You're all probably sitting there sick of hearing about Lila at this point, but she's insufferable. She is the female version of Quoth, okay? Quoth is to Lila what Lila is to Quoth, okay?
That's a good comparison.
How I feel about her, okay? Man. Is Quoth the worst character ever? No, but he just sucks to follow. I read him and I go, you suck. You are, this isn't just a female strong protagonist thing. Male protagonists like Quoth fall under the same stupid trap of look at this nothing burger of a character. So Lila, in the case where I wanted to say your good point you made in book club, was about how this I'm not like other girls cliche comes from this stance of you have to have these attributed masculine traits. Did you want to go into that? Because
sure, that's part of the idea of that cliche of, oh, I'm not like other girls. And it's this whole idea that for a woman to be considered strong, they have to be they shirk off their feminine traits and adopt masculine ones. It's the common thing of Lila is strong. She doesn't wear dress. She wears pants.
And not trousers, and even though it's in
London. It's not trousers. It's pants.
I think
that's,
was it
that's a
Shadow
little...
was Emily the one that told us that? Thank you.
I think so.
Thank you, Emily.
Yeah. Thank you, Emily.
We did not catch that. That was book club that
you
caught
were
that.
Paying attention.
Yes, we would not have caught that. But. No.
So it's one of those things of does a woman have to have all feminine traits to be considered strong? No. But also the reverse. Like, you don't need to make a woman reject all ideas of femininity to make her actually strong. You can be feminine and strong at the same time. That's a thing.
Masaki.
Vin.
Yeah, Vin.
Vin. Mm-hmm. Vin is a great example of, like, one, you think, oh, all these different masculine traits, you know, just stereotypical ones, and then finding her more, you know, feminine side and realizing she likes these type of things that she never had the opportunity to, but that doesn't make her any less strong or capable.
Right.
But yeah, that's an annoying cliche.
Yeah.
That, yeah, it's just annoying.
It is.
I don't think it's like, ah, oh, this is terrible. It's just, yeah, I've annoying. Seen it before. Yeah. It's like, be better. Do a little bit more complex. It just makes you know everything about the character without reading any further.
Yeah.
It's more fun if they're a bit more dynamic. But yeah, that's Lila, though. Like, was there anything more on Kel?
No, but the other thing about Lila...
there's nothing to talk about with him.
He is dull.
He's so dull. He has nothing.
He has that little family dynamic. And to answer your question from 20 minutes ago before we started talking about Lila again, he had a moment with the family where the mom and dad was asking, the king and queen, was asking, where's Rye?
Mm-hmm.
And not wondering where he was or something like that. And then he went, oh, I noticed that. Oh, they said, where's my son? Something like that. And Kel goes, I recognize they said, where's their son, Rye? You know, didn't include me as part of their son. I remember there was a moment there. And so we're supposed to go, okay, this is moment. Now, however, is that character flaw? Is that internalized? Is that expressed throughout the story? Is there TBD, I guess. However, it's there.
Yeah.
It's presented. That's something.
It's presented kind of in the beginning and kind of at the end. And in nowhere is it explored in the middle. Yeah.
The most interesting character is Holland.
Oh, yeah, by far.
The bad Antari.
Which is also handled with... actually, it's handled fine enough, I guess. But, yeah, no, Holland is somewhat interesting in the sense of he's compelled, and so you're thinking of this twisted evil character, but he's forced by magic to do everything. He basically doesn't even have a soul at this point. He's a backseat driver in his own mind. And... yeah, Kel kills him and gives him the mercy, kind of. They feel sympathy for him, but not too much. Definitely not too much sympathy, which is strange.
Yeah.
That's the same thing with a lot of these characters that have been compelled by magic. There does seem to be a distinct lack of sympathy for them, where it's not really thought, it's just, oh, they're villains.
Right.
Even though it's on the surface, you should think that there'd be more to it, more empathy.
There is nothing to the twins. The twin antagonists.
That
frustrated you.
I disliked the villains the most in this. I thought there was going to be... this ties a little bit into plot, but I think it does go into characters. With the plot, there's effectively three sides we're dealing with. We got Kel and Lila. We have the twins, Astrid and...
Athos and Astrid Dane. Yep.
Yeah, the Danes. And then we have the black magic kind of working on its own. And so we have these three sides of the field. And ultimately, I thought it would be kind of interesting. I thought there was going to be more of, like, the twins trying to use the black magic, but ultimately it starts corrupting things, and now they're fighting against the black magic while Kel is fighting both. Something of them being competent. But then they just ultimately they're just mustache twirling evil people that have no real grand plans other than kill a bunch of people, take control, and that's it.
And they reveal the plan too.
Also, they're just kind of dumb with the magic too. They're supposed to be really competent with, like, some talented magicians and they let the black magic run amok, and it's whatever.
Their whole plot contrivance, which, do you want to go on to plots now? Anything else with characters?
Yeah, there's not much else. Let's go into plot.
So plot, I gave it a 2.25 stars. Very disappointing.
I gave it a 2.
Flawed for you?
Flawed. Yeah.
Yeah. The I had my characters and message, so the characters was the lowest. I think the reason this book isn't any lower is, at the very least, the cool concept and the pace of the story, I'll give credit where, hey, this was... I don't want to use the word fun. This was... Okay, the back of the book says, addictive and immersive, this series is a must-read, from Entertainment Weekly. I wouldn't say addictive either, but I would say, okay, I could fly through it, and there's a lot of books that you read and you groan through. When in truth, you groan through.
Yeah.
As much as we're complaining about the cliches or look at this not like other girls, to just give a moment of levity, a moment of credit to the book is... I like how it was structured with these different sections and chapters, and I mean, I think that's part of the structure and plot of the book. And also, credit where credit's due, of even though it's a fetch quest, sorry, not fetch quest, it's a destroy ring of Mordor, get the black stone.
The reverse fetch quest.
Reverse fetch quest. I like that story type because I just like that story type to begin with. It's a neat one to go down. I'm trying to be positive, just we had a lot of negatives. Do you have any positives to start off with before we dip down into negativity land again?
Yeah, I think it's flawed, but you're right. Pacing is pretty good through most of the book, except for the ending is, I think, very rushed.
Mm.
But yeah, no, I didn't groan through it. It wasn't... There weren't any points that I just had to put it down because I just could not continue with it.
We've read worse.
Oh, yeah, I've read worse... Mm. Plotted books. I've read worse books in general. It was just more of a tiring book of like, I've seen this before and I've seen it done much better. And yeah, just cringe most of the time.
A good example, if people have read Thousand Deaths of Artur Benn, not spoiling that book whatsoever, but why I'd even say this plot I prefer to Thousand Deaths of Artur Benn is it doesn't overstay its welcome. It goes through all the beats in a time that it doesn't stay too long for me to complain. It moves on from the stuff I might even be disliking to, okay, what's happening next? Mm-hmm. Whereas it doesn't stretch out the story, which, if anything, having four different worlds and four different Londons, maybe this book could have used more time developing those. So I'm being hypocritical already. But yeah, so some positives there. But back into negativity land of you said the antagonists.
I did not like the Danes' plan. Yeah. Everything involved with it was fairly boring. They're supposedly really smart when they have to be, real dumb when the plot needs them to be. Ultimately, the ending of just big old fight. And like the fact that the Danes are so smart and that they just let Kel and Lila just walk in. Even though Kel would have lost if he had to fight all the soldiers, like, just kill him, be done. And like, no, we got to have that fight. And that's classic. You see that everywhere, but it's just overstated so much in this one, how much Holland, like, they didn't need this whole contrived plan for controlling Kel and making Kel deliver the black magic rock.
I have it here. Do you want me to read it off?
Yeah. You could have just used Holland because he wasn't completely in your control.
He asked here, yeah, why not Holland to smuggle the stone here? He obviously delivered the necklace to Rye. The necklace that Kel's referring to is what Rye wore and then was possessed by the twins, one of the twins, the queen. But this is the answer that the twin gives to them. I wanted you. I told you once that I would own your life. Besides, it made sense. If things went wrong and Holland was caught, the guilt would lie on our crown, and we would not have another chance. If things weren't wrong and you were caught, the guilt would lie on your head. I know of your hobbies, Kel. You think the scorched bone keeps secrets? Nothing goes unnoticed in my city.
Yeah, the thing is, it wouldn't matter. Like, okay, Kel gets caught. Oh, Kel was working with Grey London. Great. Guess what? Grey London's cut off again. It doesn't matter. It ultimately, it's clearly a problem with the plot that the author wrote in this explanation, and it just doesn't hold water.
It's a poor excuse to justify needing this story to exist.
Yes.
You're going, okay, we need to have the twin for some reason really want Kel and wants to corrupt Kel.
And thing is, maybe there'd be more to it if the book established some degree of a relationship between the two.
Mm-hmm.
Of maybe give us another scene or two of they've had this ongoing relationship. Maybe give us some reason on why the specifically Astrid would come up with this more dangerous, contrived plan to corrupt Kel rather than just doing the easier, more foolproof plan of use Holland and then you win. Hell, you could have Holland like put a compelling necklace around Kel. Seems to work. So
it would probably rewritten in that you can't do it to Antari.
Yeah, it probably, yeah. But I don't know. You could Holland was clearly compelled. Why can't Holland just like grab him? He's clearly stronger. They've knocked him out with different gases and like chloroform. So clearly you could just hold him down, force him, and then you're done.
Yep.
So yeah, that's the ending though. The rest of the plot itself is fine, I guess. It's just a little boring.
Yeah, the end of the book ends with Holland being sent with the stone to Black London. Mm-hmm. They get a dying Holland, or at least a close on to dying, on the verge of dying Holland, sent to Black London. That's how they get rid of the stone. The adventure up to that point, it's Lila and Kel on this journey. Kel starts in Grey London, then goes to Red London, then to White, and then ending in Black. So you have this trajectory of, okay, you know how the plot's set up. You know, the mid-journey would be more interesting and fun if each of those had some cool, unique features to make those sections more thrilling. At the same time, was there a moment in the book, was there the midpoint or something that was the most invigorating to you? Why? So the ending being the most disappointing and flawed, what before that point made you a bit more hopeful about it or interested in the premise?
I mean, there was nothing particularly grabbing, but if I had to pick one, it would be the dynamic between Kel and Rye.
Yeah.
Or am I getting that right? Rye. Yeah. So with, you know, Kel basically binding his life to Rye and all this stuff, and it's like, all right, you see the pull between the two of them of like real brothers, and there's that family connection to them. But other than that, what about you?
Yeah, I kind of agree. The Rye-Kel stuff was the most wholesome. Mm-hmm. And I think I'm giving a lot of credit to the idea as well, because I think Vishwa came up with something that could have been, I guess I see the potential of the book. Mm. I see this book could be a great book if you just change all the characters. And I think that there's something to it with Rye and Kel's relationship. There's grander things being hinted at with Lila and her Antari-ness and et cetera. But there was I'll say this. Here's why the plot wasn't awful. There was enough mystery and there was enough intrigue to push me forward into reading this, where I was interested in, even though by the end felt flat, but I was interested in the different Londons. I was interested in the question to, like, for example, we still didn't get it answered. Why is Black London Black London? What happened to the magic? And that compelling question made this book, that's where I'll give it. It made it fun to read. What is that mystery? Okay, so the V. Schwab did a good job with that. I'm good. I can find something
Say
positive.
Good.
This is good. Okay. I'm so happy. This is great. A little positivity of that was a compelling question to ask, and I have some theories about it. We talked in the book club about some theories of, is Black London actually full of magic, and it's actually a great place to be. However, they blocked off the other Londons. Is that a theory? However, having the stone and seeing how powerful the stone is, maybe that's not the theory. But that compelling question throughout of simple plot stuff. You're in gray, then red, then white, then that. And the conflicts between each of the Londons because White feels betrayed by Red and Red closed off and it's Red's fault. So that grander intrigue was something that pulled me through. Even though we didn't get the answer at the end, I was going, all right, I'm still interested. I would read book two just to go, what's the answer to what is Black London? This book left me questioning enough of, I kind of want to know that. Mm. And that at the very least, even though I have a ton of complaints, the central thing of I was asking a question and it had me hooked with that idea.
Basically, if someone told you that book two actually didn't follow Lila or Kel, and it was completely new characters, but we get to discover more about Black London.
I'm in.
You'd be like, I'm down.
I'm kind of down for that. Yeah. Were you interested in the mystery? It was something that got me. I guess I was
a little
bit. Yeah.
Not great. Okay. Not grand. No.
I'm simpler. I go, ooh, mystery. Ooh. Mystery. Who is Galadriel? Who's Sauron? Is Sauron around this corner?
Is it the mysterious stranger? Or is it the more handsome mysterious stranger?
Ooh. Was Black London the friends we made along the way? But yeah, that's the best part I could say about this. That is why I was like, oh, cool. Interesting.
Good.
Yeah. Now, the actual micro beats of that, complaints everywhere. However, fun idea, fun mystery, and miserable, miserable Lila. So that is, anything else you have on plot?
No, that's about it.
Okay. World building. What'd you give out of 5 stars?
I think I probably gave it a little high than it deserves, but I give it a 3.25.
Above average?
Above average. I think the intrigue of the multiple Londons is...
That's fair.
Bumps it up a little bit, but I'll have my complaints.
I did say 2 stars. I did say flawed. I'm interested in all that stuff. I think we've built up enough about it to where our opinions are. You're interested in the concepts.
I also think the descriptions of the world was not too jarring. Like, I was immersed enough in the story. I wasn't taken out particularly of this world. So even though a lot of it is fairly surface deep, I thought it was above average. I think I've read a lot of below average worlds that I'm like, you know what? This is...
It's better than an Abercrombie world, you're saying.
Honestly, about the same.
About
sometimes.
The same, yeah.
Sometimes. Yeah.
Does it have a map? Then it would be better than Abercrombie.
That's
Hold on.
True.
Decide now.
Does it have a map?
Moment of truth.
It...
Nope.
Kinda,
not a real map.
Not a. It's like in the cover, kind of in the background. No map. It's not better than Abercrombie.
Dock it 0.25 just for that. But this is. We've talked about the Londons. I think I probably gave more credit in the plot to the idea and the concept of the book, because the actual Londons themselves were sure similar Londons with different levels of magic. And I guess why I said flawed is just the
concept of white London just doesn't work.
Also, the concept of the magic that the Antari have and the Black Stone, like, you even just brought up a point of when they just put the thing on Kel. And the power and the abilities for the villains to get their tasks done more easily with the magic system doesn't seem like the magic and the world of V. Schwab's Four Londons world effectively is shown, is effectively demonstrated through the plot. It doesn't feel as though the magic works with the plot like a tight-fitting knot in that way.
Also, the magic and the world-building, I think the closest you come to it is in White London, the idea of everyone using these runes and tattoos to keep the magic inside and to keep it from leaking out is more of an integration into the visual aspect of the world and how that's changing the culture around White London. That's actually a well-done implementation of merging the culture and the magic to make it all kind of one.
Yeah.
With Red London, it feels like just London, but occasionally there's a magical thing described. But it doesn't feel any different. You don't see any aspect of how magic is fully integrated into their culture. You don't see it. Or how it changes their technology. How is it any different than Grey London? It just seems generally happier, but that's about it.
Yeah, the more you're talking about it too, I think you're probably, is there something wrong with it? Flawed? Probably not. I'll probably have to go up to disappointed or very disappointed, because it's more so it had the potential to be a cool world.
You're more let down by what it could have been. But on its surface, like when I'm thinking like world building,
yeah,
the descriptions of the world are adequate enough of like, I'm still there. I'm not confused on where I am. There is a distinct, maybe I want more out of the descriptions of the world.
That's fair.
I do want more.
I'm asking
but
a question,
I can generally picture the difference between Grey London, Red London, and White London. They did feel different. There's a cultural change. Yeah, I could use more. But it's at least established well enough that I'm not taken out of the story. So, yeah, I'd say it's above average.
I'll up mine to like 2.5 or something. Yeah, I'll up mine a little bit. Because you're right. My main interest too is what's Black London like, and yeah. I'm compelled by okay, the world. I'm interested at least. Now, did I think it missed the mark? It could have been so much more. Yeah, I think that's where the disappointing part about it is. The world has something. It just could have been so much more explored. The London's, again, idea is very cool. So this is a very repetitive episode, but when are we not? So that, yeah, I'll up mine to 2.5. There we go. All right.
I'm doing the Lord's work here. Yep.
You're making me think more fondly on it. Okay. Other the stone, the Antari, the four Londons, I'm trying to think of other
I think
features.
It's good to mention at least that the magic system absent the stone in Antari, the traveling stuff, like the regular magic,
yeah,
this is kind of boring. It's just general elemental magic. Mm. It's not particularly fun. I've seen it thousands of times at this point, and it's like, I don't know. You want a little something more. Yeah. But... do you judge a book when it's something you've already seen over and over again? You judge them by the execution. And so I don't think it was really executed well or creatively. Same thing with the Antari magic was at least like the little special sauce. It was, you know, oh, it has to be word activated. It's by the blood. I don't know. I was kind of dulled by the magic. So that's an aspect like where I've seen it before. It's doesn't break anything, but it also doesn't elevate the story and make you think about it.
Agreed. It just had a bunch of Leviosas, but without the cool Hogwarts parts.
Yeah, basically.
Yeah.
No, like, Hogwarts, like, Harry Potter magic system works because of the descriptions and all the little things that makes it feel mystical. It makes, like, it's a vibe rather than, like, the magic system. That's not the point. It's the ever-changing staircases. It's the paintings that talk. Like, that's the magical world is integrated into your daily life. Versus if we saw in Red London how much magic is used on a daily basis between people, it changes how people walk. It changes how people get their food. Like, just a maybe a little bit of a whimsy if you see packages and, like, you Lilo comes into Red London and notices that the streets are fairly empty. There's a lot of people, but there are no roads because people don't need to actually drive things on carts anymore. She looks up and she sees packages and things being flown about the city because things are flown around. Like, something like that to add to, like, oh, this is different. This is an integrated magical society. That would have added a little bit more.
I agree. Yeah, 100% agreed. Yeah, that's the world building section.
Yep.
Anything else for world building?
Nah, that's about it.
Pros, I gave it a 2 stars. Flawed.
I gave it a 2.75.
Below average.
Below average.
Okay.
I'm just kind of jaded at the point of, like, I've read real bad pros. I was never confused.
That's true. However,
I knew where I was. I just thought the dialogue was cringe.
So I'll make my case for the 2 star, for the flaw. Now, first, there was a line. There's these cliche lines where you'll agree with one of the villains, one of the Danes said during the action scene, oh, yes, I'm going to enjoy this.
Oh, yeah.
There was that scene. There's Coop, shout out Coop, was so annoyed by every single time Kel would say, Lila, run! Run, Lila! Run, Forrest, run! Constantly saying run to Lila was... rampant throughout the book. You have the dialogue scene that was mentioned earlier with them kissing for good luck, but not that you'll need it, putting your hand on the wall, just that kind of cringy stuff. So that's some of the pros there. Now, here's a couple things I want to bring to your attention. So I have a section of the pros to bring up here. But however, first I opened up when I saw this book, I looked to that one page earlier on, if you'll remember. Where was it? Yes. Remember when I quoted earlier that scene, for luck, not when you need it and put your hand above there, okay?
Yeah.
So in that, I noticed the repetition of a word here. I was going, oh, wow, how often is that used? So here's part of the dialogue. And then he pulled Lila close, wrapped his broken body around hers, dot, dot, dot. And at the end of this, and then he pressed his hand against the wall and thought of home, dot, 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 dot. And I went, oh, and then, okay, how often is that used? So I opened to a random page. I went to, okay, I had to save it, though, to page 109. I was just going, how often this is used? I opened it, and I saw the word and then. I went, oh, interesting. So it says, and then, in the distance, someone screamed, and the sound, dot, 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 whatever. It's like, okay, when's the next time that's said? So look, it's like a chapter break, so there's nothing there. Then you go to the next page, it's chapter intro, I go, I'm like, oh, and then she was off. Okay, next page. And then, sure enough, he saw something move. Interesting, next page. And then she heard the shuffle of steps rushing behind her, dot, 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 okay. And then, an instant later, dot, 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 dot. And then I was like, that's so strange. Just, okay, then I went to, I opened up another random spot at 216. I tried middle of the book-ish right here. I opened it up. I go, oh, that's weird. Okay, here's how a paragraph starts. And then she turned a corner, dot, dot, dot. And I'm like, oh, that's interesting. I couldn't find another one, so I turned the page. Oh, there it is. And then came the night to top their mounts, dot, dot, dot. I looked to the next page. And then the moment passed, dot, dot, dot. I opened up to the next page. Next page. And then the merchant raised his voice. Stressed, he shouted, dot, dot, dot. And then she caught the word again, gasped, dot, dot, dot. And I kept looking, how often was it used to change action scene that Schwab just used? And then this happened. And then
this happened.
And then Lila did this, and then she did this. So it's one of those things I noticed, well, upon just reading that section and going, how often is that repeated? So to change her transition scenes to go from one to the next was so many of the times. And then Lila did this. And then Kel did that. And then Rye did that. And then this is what happened in the book. Rather than if you're just going to write the scene, you just go write the scene of, you don't have to have the and then happen. It's kind of superfluous. I guess.
You could just write what happens sequentially. Yeah.
Now, is that a writing tool of you want to have and then to make it feel a certain way and feel more action-y of this? And then, well, boom, this happens.
You could also use other phrases and suddenly. This, mm-hmm. or shortly after, whatever.
It seemed to be the usage of that.
Suddenly,
and
blah. But.
Exactly. And there was the usage of, Emily said in the book club, the italics and parentheses being used quite a bit, just as a bit of annoying mm-hmm. writing style, or just a feature that can get a little bit overused. However, was this readable? Yes. Very readable, easy to read. It didn't distract in the way of you're reading that and then line or whatever and going, oh, I have to put this down because it's so difficult to read. No. Mm-hmm. I think the corniness of the dialogue scenes, and I want to emphasize too, it's if it was just that, there's also the action scenes in this book of the prep to the action. So that scene I read earlier with Lila of her about to die and that threatening the repetition of this, oh my God, is she going to die? What's happening here? I think both the actions happening in those fields and the dialogue itself are both written in a way that don't make my heart start pumping. And it
blends
none
together.
Of it,
there's no real change of pace.
The action reads like the dialogue and the dialogue reads like the monologues and the monologues read like the take whatever you will.
No, that's a general good rule with writing, or at least it's a little tool, it's a little trick that authors can use, is changing the sentence pace and structure of, if you're have these long-winded monologue scenes, you let the sentences drag out a little bit, you let the paragraphs drag a bit longer, and then with, you want exciting, fast action, like the sudden change to shorter, like staccato sentences. Just the change and the difference between the two gets you to focus on it a little different way, and it feels a bit more exciting. And this doesn't really do that.
There was an attempt at that too, where it actually came across, I know what you're supposed to feel. There was a scene where Kel was thinking about Rye, mm-hmm. and do you remember the beat per beat going, Rye was this, Rye was this, Rye was,
oh.
Rye was hurt, Rye was duh, Rye was duh, like, there was 10 sentences a row of talking about how much he was thinking about Rye in an emotional moment. So there was some of that. Why didn't that come across correctly? Because I know I'm supposed to go, oh, that's the staccato moment. That's the moment of caring.
It was a little bit too much repetition and not enough. That whole sentence structure is mainly to show Kel breaking down and his thoughts like going fast rapid. Like, it probably would have been a lot more effective of start off, Rye was this, Rye is dying, Rye is this, and then just dying, falling, just make it as it continues on, breaking down shorter and shorter and less coherent sentences and, like, not full-ass sentences. Right. And start dropping.
They were full.
And then instead of even talking about just Rye, something like that. Because it's supposed to be loss of sanity. Hey, there we go.
Rye wearing her talisman. Rye flashing a smile that was too cruel and too cold to be his own. Rye curling his fingers around Kel's throat and whispering in his ear with someone else's words. Rye thrusting a knife into his stomach. Rye, his Rye, crumpling to the floor. Rye bleeding. Rye dying. Then continues from there. So the last two words, Rye bleeding, Rye dying, to get shorter at the end. So that there is the staccato attempt, right?
Yeah. But
you're talking about
how can we maybe break down why that is the reason that doesn't work because it's surrounded by the context of the rest of the book, and because we're just not into the rest of the book,
right?
That doesn't land. Or is there anything particular about that scene and that way it's written?
I think the context around it definitely leads me to feel that way, because now when you're on alert and you go, okay, you're already picking out flaws in a book, you're more likely to spot when an author is using different tools. Of if Abercrombie or somebody else were to write that, you'd kind of be into it and invested in thinking about the action, because you're not focused on trying to find every nitpicking word or whatever's popping up on page. So part of it has to be that you're more on alert. As soon as you distrust an author to you see them as fallible, then you're going, oh, okay, now I'm looking for all the fallible parts of the book. So that's the first thing. But the second is because the dialogue scenes that we've read up to this point and seeing the more triteness of it, seeing that, now you're going, look at the other literary device that's being used in the scene. So I guess you're right. It's more the context of it that's kind of aiding toward it. I guess so.
Fair enough. Yeah, I have read way worse books for myself, and so below average, but not taken out completely the story. Just some cringe dialogue, and the action wasn't that enthralling.
Yeah, as much as we went on all about that, I think the worst part about it is the dialogue by far.
Yeah,
the dialogue is where it's real bad, and the other stuff is passable words. Now, all this, I know we haven't had a complete dislike from both of us toward a book in a while. So we had to get our punches in just to show, hey, we dislike stuff.
We also dislike things.
Yes.
We're not just positive rays of sunshine, you know, giving every book 5 stars. I know everyone thinks of us as really,
of course,
upbeat, positive. We rarely ever dislike anything. I know that's our impression, but we can also dislike things too.
We dislike probably most of you watching this. In fact, if you comment, Rich is not going to like you because he thinks people that comment are weird.
That is true. It's weird. I don't understand talking on the internet. I don't get it.
I think it's even weirder.
I like it on the receiving end of, like, oh, it's fun. I actually get to be I get to read your comments. That's neat. And it's enjoyable of the interaction. But, like, the reverse situation, I can never see myself on the other side. I've never commented on a video ever on YouTube.
You commented once on Facebook ever.
That is true.
I love that story.
Yeah, that's it's a funny. Good one.
Yeah.
Good old Aunt Kathy. I'm there for you. I'm defending you in the Facebook page.
So something got you riled up enough to go, you know what, Aunt Kathy, I'm here for you.
This goddamn in-law. In-law going in on my Aunt Kathy. Can't have none of that. None of that upstart energy.
Now you understand why they comment, is they see how much you come after me, and they go and they pile on. They don't even defend.
I think most people defend you.
I think that's Rich coming from Rich.
I think you are the more loved podcast host.
I disagree. I
completely disagree.
I think I am the established villain
no, of this channel.
No, so you come off villainous and edgy, and people are like, oh, I kind of like that.
Oh, no, they find it cringe.
No,
I completely understand. Nope. They're like, ugh, this guy just doesn't like things. He's just so, yeah, I understand. Then, I'm the villain. I take the role.
No, then they look at me and they go, how could you give Red Rising 5 stars and a Joe Abercrombie finale 2 something? And they look at, oh, look at simple brained like this, doesn't like this. And they go, I need somebody that actually knows what they're talking about. They look to you.
I don't think so. Maybe in the beginning, that was I don't think that is anymore.
I think if you look at this comment section right now, which they're actually, how far are we? Ah, we got
pretty good. It's a lot longer than I thought it would be.
Yeah, I think we went into Lila quite a bit.
Yeah.
Now, answer down below. Rank these. Rank these in order. And you can have a tie for last, okay? Rank these three, Lila, Rich, and me. And you can have a tie for last. I just want everyone to go along. And if I
Austin, Richard, and Lila last. Yeah, I get it. I see it.
Either that or us last.
Yes.
And Lila first. Yes. That would get on my gears. Here's the thing, if I'm ahead of you, great. Yeah. If I'm behind Lila, if I'm behind you, I'm okay with that. If I'm behind Lila, I'm not okay with that.
Phrasing. But okay.
If I am below you, no.
No, no, still not working.
If I am... We'll see you next episode. I'm in a trap. I don't know how to get out of it. Goodbye.
Goodbye. At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.